Welcome to the New Zealand Tech Podcast, presented by Paul Spain and guests.
Welcome along to the New Zealand Tech Podcast. This is episode 151. I'm Paul Spain.
I'm Alistair Cook.
And I'm Peter Hall.
Welcome along, guys. Good to have you on the show. And Peter, your first time, so thanks for joining us.
Yeah, I'm excited to be here. Thank you.
Now, just fill us in where you fit into the tech world.
Into the tech world. Well, I am currently running an event that is launching this weekend called Digital Nations, which is New Zealand's first digital entertainment expo.
Woohoo. Sounds cool. And Alistair?
I work in enterprise IT, and I run a podcast around server virtualization, which is the V Brown Bag podcast.
Excellent. Well, thanks again for being back on the show. Now, let's jump in a few topics to talk about, including, of course, Digital Nations. We'll come to that in a little while. Now, first up, BlackBerry. Now, they've been in the media. They announced late last week they had made a loss in the last quarter of close to $1 billion, which is kind of a major amount of money for, you know, what is becoming a smaller business.
A billion US dollars. So yeah. Basically, Grand Theft Auto made the money that they lost in one day.
Yeah.
Wow.
Yeah.
That's pretty rough.
Yeah, no, and what did the sales of Grand Theft Auto work out at?
First 24 hours was $800 million.
But over a few days, it went up to in the direction of $3 billion, didn't it?
Yeah.
Yeah.
So you've got BlackBerry on one side losing $1 billion over... Was that just for the quarter?
Yeah.
Wow.
Yeah. So some big dollars there. But also following that, we've now had the announcement that BlackBerry have an offer on the table from their biggest investor to take them private, so for them to disappear off the stock exchange. $4.7 billion deal there that will return them into private ownership.
So we won't see that the stock price has dropped from its high of about $227 a share down to today $8.82 a share. It's a big fall from grace.
Yeah, I mean, you're talking 5%, aren't you, in that sort of region of
the valuation,
or less of their peak on the stock exchange.
Well, I mean, it is interesting to see, and you've got to wonder with a company like BlackBerry, with Nokia and the Microsoft deal obviously happening earlier as well, what the future for BlackBerry really is, and actually what the future for Nokia is as well. I'm not entirely convinced about that one either. I mean, can they sustain it either way? I don't know.
Yeah, I think they have been in that situation where they need to do what Microsoft did and throw away everything they've done in the past and build something completely new that matches current consumer expectation. They couldn't rest on having BlackBerry Messenger, which was certified for security in a million ways, and then, of course, now Prism shows us that that the NSA could see everything anyway. We're no longer so sure that there was any security in it.
Well, I guess the difference that we see between BlackBerry and Windows Phone is that Windows Phone's growing in market share now, whereas BlackBerry's still going in.
Well, I don't feel that BlackBerry have done that, reinvent themselves the way that Microsoft have done to get that success, particularly in our market.
Well, maybe they just left it too late, because Microsoft launched Windows Phone 7 in 2010. So we're talking 3 years ago, and it's really just been this year that we've seen the fresh start from BlackBerry.
Well, I think that they're in a different situation. Windows is more of they've got the integration of a product range that actually makes sense. So for them, they're on so many different, they've got the Windows 7 operating system and everything else, Windows 8 obviously, and then being able to shift that over and actually do it with hardware and phones makes sense. But the problem with BlackBerry is they've got one OS sitting on phones. Where are they going to go with it? Android's, pretty much, swamping them market. Windows is getting up there when it comes to market share. Apple's obviously strong, and they've got a strong connection between the iPad and the iOS 7 and, being everywhere as well. So how do you survive with your own operating system that has no real breadth? I don't know.
I think it's very hard. You need that ecosystem.
Yeah.
And you also need a business that's got deep pockets. And the issue with BlackBerry is they don't have a whole lot of other, areas where they're making billions of dollars on other things to help them fund, make mobile work. That's all they've got. And with a declining market share, it's pretty challenging. The one good point on BlackBerry's front is they've got BlackBerry Messenger launching for iOS and Android that should spread things out a little bit. The only downside of that is they announced this late last week, and I remember getting some info through saying, yes, this is happening, and then I followed up to say, hey, where is it? I can't seem to find it. All I can see is sort of, you know, in the Google Play Store, you always sort of get, you know, dodgy versions of apps and so on that that appear that aren't the real thing. And it turns out that there was a pre-release version of their app that did get leaked, installed on lots and lots of devices, that was causing major problems with their servers. And so they've pushed the whole general availability of BlackBerry Messenger out by a week or so, apparently. So we're still playing a waiting game to get hands on that. So a little bit of a mess there in the midst of their good news about being bought out. Now, iOS 7, that's, of course, landed in the last few days. Any thoughts on that, Alistair?
Well, I followed my children's advice and upgraded my iPad Mini. They both have iPhones and immediately upgraded. So when I came back from travel, they said, oh, you're behind the times, Dad, which is not what I expect to hear from my children. And I put the upgrade on, very smooth, easy, no loss of functionality. The new user interface feels a bit like a children's toy to me. It doesn't feel quite so business-oriented. I think it's the pastel-y colours and the swishy bits. That might make it very desirable for consumers, because I'm an old fuddy-duddy.
Well, I think you're right. Definitely, my girlfriend's got it on her phone. I used to be all Apple, and now suddenly I'm all Samsung and kind of the googly side of things. But what strikes me is they've innovated by taking the best features of Google Android, which apparently they allegedly are supposed to be leading the game. And what they've done is most of the things my girlfriend was showing me, saying, oh, look at this menu, I can now control my Wi-Fi on and off, and I can do, I'm like, yeah, that's pretty much what's been in Android since day one. So it's, I don't know if it's an admission of, yes, we don't always know the best solutions of things, and we're quite willing to do our own interface, make it look really cool, but actually just rip off everybody else's functionality and put it in there, or if it's, you know, a sign of, you know, how they see the market in general going, well, people are used to it, so it's easier for people to adopt from an Android phone into an, I don't know, but it's felt very
derivative,
and I didn't see the innovation in there. You know, you look at it and you go, it's not that much different.
You wonder whether if Steve Jobs was still with us and still at the helm, whether people would have been sacked for suggesting that this occur. And I see a couple of the things that come out of Apple in the last couple of years where I think, well, this is things that Steve would have sent people packing for and would have demanded more and better. And I suspect that's why we saw the drop in Apple stock price after the announcement of the 5S and the 5C.
Well, they were retreads. They were. I mean, the mantra and whatever structure he might have put in place, my biggest problem with that structure is, I don't know if he thought that indefinitely they could keep going with this, because clearly they cannot. And I think they know that. They're going to have to come out with the 6. They can't wait another year.
Yeah, I mean, they do seem to have this sort of model of, you know, doing the big product and then the smaller change around hardware. But, I mean, I've been using iOS 7 too. I quite like it. You know, you're right, there are things, and I think we're seeing this across all platforms, really, is each platform, you know, if they see something that's good that they don't have, sure, they're going to draw on that if they can work out a way that fits in with the way they operate to, you know, to deliver that. And, yeah, I think, you know, each one will continue to draw on what the other ones are doing. But it seems to work well, and certainly the new hardware, you know, that just continues to step up. I don't think we're probably going to see, you know, Apple sales numbers sort of decline or anything like that. I think the market's growing. They're continuing to sort of position themselves, probably, I think, at that sort of premium end. I think there was that thought that, hey, the 5C is going to be, you know, a lower cost device, but it's not. And you know, they've proven by having high end devices, they can be a pretty profitable company.
That is sticking true to.
They would risk cannibalizing their profits, really, if they release a much lower cost device.
They've always wanted to be a premium device, and I think that's true. The whole product range, it's got to be an aspirational device, and you can't make a cheap aspirational device.
But and the thing is, their whole the whole strategy, which isn't actually a bad one as well, is hand-me-downs. Like it's the kids that we're seeing with the iPhones are using their dad's iPhone that he had because he got a new one through work that he paid for, and then he hands it to his kid or whatever. So their strategy is, why would we make a low one when we know that the dad's going to buy the new one and hand his old one to his kid anyway? Mm-hmm. And yes, the kid isn't going to be there necessarily on the latest generation, but even if they've got a 5 now, they're going to be stoked. Figure that, getting an iPhone 5, and you know, because your dad got an iPhone 5S. That's awesome. So I can see where they're going with it. It's not a bad strategy.
Yeah, I think it's working reasonably well for them. They're still making profits that are out of this world, and it's a sign of the sales. I think they shared some sales figures around the launch in the US and various other markets, New Zealand not included. Of was it 9 million handsets sort of sold over the weekend, which I think was a record for them. There was that sort of the stock price drop after the announcement, in reality they're actually selling truckloads of product. So yeah, I don't think they're in too bad a state.
Well, I think the stock price doesn't necessarily reflect anything specific about the company so much as sentiment amongst the people who buy and sell the stock.
I do wonder, though, if they are going to become a little bit more nimble, because I know from hearing a few people that work within the Apple sphere, it feels like this was the first year they actually sensed a little bit of panic when they saw what Samsung was doing to them in the market. And I would argue that this might be the last year we see. So I wasn't blown away by the changes in the phones, and they felt like they were kind of like meh, evolution, not revolution, you know, all that kind of stuff. I wonder if from now on we'll see them close the gap, and it might not be every other year. They might need to do more every year to keep on top of them, because Samsung and HTC and these guys are just going to be hounding them down and trying to, you know, be more nimble.
True, but also we look across the industry, we're seeing the, you know, we talked about this before, sort of innovation curve that was very, very steep for a while, sort of starting really to flatten out. And when we see the differences across probably just about any vendor, the differences that we saw, you know, 2, 3, 4 years ago and so on, between one product and the next, that's now starting to reduce.
That's true.
Yeah. All right, now other bits and pieces. Now Vodafone have been working globally on a new payment system which utilizes the near field communications capability that's built into a lot of smartphones. A lot of the Android phones have it. Windows phones have it. Nothing from Apple yet. They've obviously got some other plans up their sleeve. But Vodafone have been working on this internationally. Now, we've seen in New Zealand some things from 2Degrees and most recently this year a trial with Telecom that we've talked about in the past. Vodafone have opened up this trial in New Zealand, and I believe in other markets, which looks as though it's fairly well developed. Doesn't look as though they're too far off actually launching a product based on all the documentation and so on that they've shared with us. They've right down to fee structures and so on. Now in New Zealand, they've partnered with I think it's actually on the back of their Visa. And
was it BNZ?
Yeah, BNZ.
Yeah.
BNZ,
yeah. So they've got them involved in the trial. And basically what you can do is put the special SIM into an appropriate smartphone, which at this stage I think is just limited to Android. So we've got it on a Galaxy S3 at the moment, the software. And this works a little bit differently to what we tried with Telecom. So what you do is you link an existing credit card to the kind of the virtual Visa card, and then you can move money off your existing credit card and load it onto the embedded Visa, and then you use the tap to pay at the supermarket or wherever it is that you want to pay. And, you know, the same sort of rules apply that were the standard tap to pay or whatever the Visa and MasterCard have their own terminology for that, but that's what I call it. You know, you tap your phone onto the terminal. Any transaction under $80 will just go through automatically. Over and above that, then you need to put in a PIN number. Something new, though, I have seen with what Vodafone are doing here is you can set it up so it won't do a payment unless you've authorised it on screen first. So you can actually, you know, I think some people are a little bit worried with these new types of credit cards and with payments through the phone that, you know, someone could, bump past you and take money off your account. I'm not sure that's too likely, because if there was a dodgy merchant doing that, it would soon become pretty clear to Visa or to MasterCard or banks, etc., that, look, this is a dodgy terminal and none of the transactions are actually legitimate and that'll be reversed anyway. But
I wonder if you could, just thinking about technology-wise, I wonder if it would even allow it to do a multi-tap. I wonder if it wouldn't actually allow you. Because did you mean that if they could tap to pay and then basically the receiver would kind of ping you twice?
No, more the situation where you're walking in a crowd and someone's got a portable payment terminal with you and, you know, just happen to bump up against, you know, bump
directional aerial on it so they don't have to get so close.
Those sorts of things, right? Mm. So, it would be pretty obvious once they've got a few complaints of people saying, hey, what's this transaction? Hey, what's that transaction?
Yeah.
Linked back to one terminal. So unless there's something smart that hackers can do to, vary the terminal number or something.
It's not like hackers are smart and basically break everything under the sun.
No, I'm sure
we're safe.
But anyway, so I thought that was unusual, but nice to have that option to be able to authorize, you know, when a payment's going to be made or not. So
I must say, a few things that I find interesting about this is one thing for me is We don't really talk about the other side, which is the fact that the merchants now need to start having these. Like, the amount of places I go that they don't have the tap thing, I actually find quite astonishing.
It will roll out, and I think, you know, by the time these things become really mainstream, you know, within sort of, yeah, probably 24 months, it'll be pretty broad, but you've got to get from a place where you didn't have any to where they're everywhere. In the same way it once was with FPOS. You know, lots of people didn't have FPOS. You know, now you can be, you know, out at the beach somewhere and there's a guy with a little coffee cart set up or ice creams. And he's got a mobile FPOS credit card terminal.
Yeah.
And, you know, it's almost impossible to find someone that doesn't take FPOS type technology, right?
And these things are much more widespread in Australia than they are here, which is unusual because usually we're well ahead of the Australians on adopting these things. But I use mine for
I do when I can.
My PayWave for the first time today. First time I saw a place with one that I wasn't going to spend too much to be on the limit.
Well, the other thing as well is, and I think it might be a trick that's missed so far, is all these bloody loyalty cards we have. I would love to have an NFC chip where I just loaded up all these loyalty cards, because, you know, you get them from the coffee shop and you get them from everywhere, and I hope that that's the next one, because it's great that they're doing this. I think maybe a way to get people used to it would have been better to actually do the free solutions first, right? So they get a sense of, I can use this, I'm using this for my loyalty cards. And then when you've got people used to that, you go, hey, now how about using that for your payments as well?
Yeah, and some of the solutions that we've looked at already have that type of capability that they've been working on and
deployed.
Vodafone are talking about this in some of the marketing material in some of the countries. They're talking about moving to loyalty cards in the future on this solution.
Yeah, and the telecom one that we looked at had a sort of an area for that. I'm not sure it was all fully rigged up yet.
Yeah.
But those things are certainly will come over time. And I guess the most obvious one is the supermarket.
Yeah, exactly.
One, because you carry around those
flybys and the
one cards and things like
coffee
that.
Coffee shops.
So, if they can do all that stuff, that'd be great. Now, a bit of announcement today from Microsoft around their new Surface devices. So they've announced a whole new generation of services. The Surface RT product loses the RT name, just becomes a Surface 2. And then the new Surface Pro is just Surface Pro 2. But I guess the big bit around it was that there's a broader range of accessories this time round that will make the Surface products, I think, much more useful. So first up, there's a docking station available for the Surface Pro series, and that'll work with the existing Surface Pros that are already out in the market. Got a whole bunch of ports in there. Have you had a look at some of the details around these accessories, Alistair?
I had a fairly cursory look at the coverage that The Verge had today, and because I use a tablet device when I'm mobile and travel a lot, and so a very small and light device, quite similar. I have a Sony equivalent. And when I come back into my apartment, I put it on a stand and plug it into an external docking station. I think it's an excellent solution for being able to use the same device in two different form factors in two different locations. And I think the docking station is a great thing to have.
Yeah, so the docking station is going to launch in New Zealand. It's called Docking Station for Surface Pro is the name I've got for it, or Surface Pro Dock. Now, it's not going to be available immediately, though. And a few of the accessories that are being announced aren't coming actually until early in the new year. 310 dollars in the New Zealand market, and that will include a power supply as well for the device.
And that's broadly comparable with what I've paid for a USB 3 equivalent device that, like this, has a connectivity for an external monitor and the usual USB ports and a wired Ethernet port. I presume that the new dock has a wired Ethernet port.
It does indeed, yeah. Yep.
Honestly, I don't have one myself. I actually really like the Surfaces. You know, there's a lot of stuff that they've put in there that I would have expected. You know, if that would have come out and it would have been an Apple product, I would have gone, yep, makes sense. You know, the kickstand, the keyboards, everything with that that makes it a device that is more. Because I've got the iPad Mini. Love it, you know, great for reading and stuff like that.
Yep.
But, you know, apart from that, it's not great. You couldn't use this laptop replacement. I actually really like the Surfaces. I think they've done a good job. It's a shame that they haven't done better so far in the market, though.
Yeah, well, I think it's good to see that they're certainly not quitting, and they're continuing to throw more at it. So the key thing that we see that stood out for me anyway on the Surface 2 is it moves to a Tegra 4 processor, which enables a few things on it. In terms of new functionality, so the display now moves to a full HD 1080p, so, you know, stunning video. They've improved, they've moved to USB 3 as well, so, you know, really fast connectivity there. The front facing camera is 3.5 megapixel, 5 megapixel rear camera, both of them able to do 1080p video. So quite a jump there in terms of specs, which is good, and it's going to come with the 8.1 version of Windows RT, and with Office, and of course that's now going to include Outlook, which we didn't see on the first generation. And then the Pro 2, the main big jump there is the inclusion. It's an i5 processor, but this is the fourth gen or the Haswell generation. So much improved battery life from what we're reading, 60% improvement in battery life. And one of the accessories is what's called a power cover, which will be a cover with a keyboard in it that also brings in, and it's the type cover style keyboard, but includes a battery in it, and that'll push up the battery life by another 50%. So, we're talking, with those two bits over 10 hours battery life.
Yeah, and we've seen similar devices, the Transformer from Asus and some of the Samsung ATIV books that glue together the keyboard slice with battery, and it seems to be a really good thing, because if you're just using the device around home for consuming, you unplug it and you're quite happy with having 6 hours of battery life. But if you then need to go and do a day's work, you don't need to take a power supply if you've got 8 hours worth of battery life.
It's, yeah.
a really sensible move.
Yeah, it's pretty handy, and I think it was, you know, one of the things that a lot of people were waiting for was this next generation of the Surface, because it's an amazing you know, form factor for what is effectively a full blown machine.
Yeah,
but it was that low battery life that was a bit of an issue for some. So just having a look at the pricing, all of this stuff's been released to us today. So the Surface 2 is going to be $649 in New Zealand with the 32 gigs worth of storage, and $799 for the 64. The Surface Pro 2 is going to start at $1,449. That's with 128 gigs of storage. And then there's a 256 gig model, which is going to be $1,879. So they've moved up the storage there. Whereas before we had 64 and 128 models, it now the very bottom is 128.
Wow.
We're also hearing, I think, about a 512 gig model launching in other markets. So, you know, I don't know whether that'll land here. And in terms of accessories, that the new touch cover, which is actually thinner again from the existing one, which I'm not quite sure how they did that, because it was already about what you would expect for a cover on one of these things anyway. But that's slimmer again, and they've got backlit keys in it, so that's kind of cool. And then there's a new type cover. The touch cover, $285, and $200 for the type cover 2. And again, that's got backlit keys. And there's a car charger as well, $80, and that dock that we mentioned at about $310. Waiting to hear about one other thing. There is still actually going to be a 64 gig model apparently of the Surface Pro 2, but I don't know whether that'll be available in the New Zealand market because we haven't seen pricing. The models with 256 and 512 were apparently coming with 8 gigs of RAM rather than 4, so they'll be definitely on the heavier end there in terms of specifications. And the other bit that they're doing is they're throwing in a bunch of SkyDrive storage, 200 gigs of cloud storage for 2 years, and a Skype account with, I think it's going to be unlimited Skype Wi-Fi, which is their Wi-Fi service that you can use to get Wi-Fi out and about on hotspots, and Skype calling to landlines in more than 60 countries for 1 year as well. So they're really trying to take advantage of that broader ecosystem in two ways. One, to make it a value add that sort of convinces you that, you know, the price you're paying for the device is actually really good because you get these other things thrown in. But I think also to move more people into their ecosystem as far as, you know, away from the likes of Dropbox and into SkyDrive. And certainly if you're going to get 200 gigs worth of storage, that'd be pretty tempting.
Yeah, I think the sheer volume of things that we end up putting on these cloud storage platforms make the free 2 or 3 gigs disappears very fast, and larger volumes required.
I mean, it is going to be interesting. You know, just back to that conversation we had previously about Apple as well. Again, you know, what is their next move in this space? Because again, I feel like they're, and we know that it's a leapfrog thing, and then they'll come out and hopefully they'll blitz it and keep the competition going. But I think that what they've got here is something that is a very viable competitor in what's becoming quite a tough market for people to enter.
Yeah, I think we've seen something new in the last couple of years from Microsoft on these things, is that they're, it used to be that their platforms were exclusive and they would deliver things like they delivered Microsoft Office as an exclusive on Windows Phone. They had SkyDrive support on Windows Phone only, and in terms of phones. But now all of these things, Microsoft is pushing them out onto iOS, onto Android, onto Mac, onto every single platform that they can.
Yeah.
And I think that's pretty important for their future, that they make themselves as accessible as possible. Yeah. So, it's certainly good good to see more competition in all of these areas, whether it's in that cloud storage or otherwise. Now, on to digital nations.
Yes.
you need to fill us in. Now, this is the first Digital Nations event, isn't it? It's happening at the Vector Arena in Auckland this weekend.
Yeah.
When does it kick off?
Yeah, so it starts, those who've got VIP tickets can get in from 9 a.m. and they basically get an hour between 9 and 10 to get hands-on with all
this
the stuff.
This is Saturday morning?
Saturday morning, yep. And then and the same again on Sunday, starts at 9 a.m. for the VIPs. So New Zealand's first digital entertainment expo, I guess. What we've been trying to do is, it's frustrating. I mean, I'm from Sweden and just spent a lot of time in Europe and in the US. And looking at the kind of preview events where you actually get to touch and play with stuff that isn't available. And I've really missed that since moving here, and I haven't really understood the reason why it doesn't exist. So, it's great with pulp culture kind of expos and things like that, but they don't fill that gap. It's not the focus, it's not what they do. And we looked at it. We've had really tight turnaround times on it, and so we basically decided we wanted to get in here, do that this year, and get the guys on board. So these Sony PlayStation and Microsoft Xbox and everybody else has come on board, and it's going to be a great weekend.
Cool. So there's going to be, you're going to have Xbox One there,
yeah.
PlayStation 4.
Yeah.
How accessible are they going to be?
Fully playable. Yeah. I mean, when it comes to how many devices, I think it's a good indication is looking, I know Sony released a press release today saying they have about, I believe it's 8 games playable on PlayStation 4. And they're also doing Watch Dogs as a demo, so they're showing that off. But the other things are actually hands-on playing. Xbox have announced, even more titles than PlayStation have so far. I'm treading a little bit cautiously because I'm still dealing with some information that we have that we can't announce yet. But highly accessible when it comes to the overall ability for people to play and actually engage and not just watch. Very, 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 very high. Very high.
Great. Oh, that's really cool. And what are the other highlights? I mean, you've got speakers in from various places, talking about gaming and game production and various other things. Who are the highlights there? We've got Kim.com plugged in, our local gaming and all sorts of
internet mogul.
Let's
stick to that.
All sorts of celebrity.
I think it's very important for us, obviously, not to just rely on one thing. I think we could have quite successfully just gone, look, it's 2 months before the launch of the products and you can get in here and play, and that would have been quite good. But we actually wanted to add things that would add even more value and make people think this is outstanding. So speakers, like you said, mentioned international speakers from Epic Games, Naughty Dog, Crytek, Capcom, an impressive lineup of international and national speakers as well. So Grinding Gear Games, those kind of guys. Got a couple of workshops that we're running on augmented reality and mobile filmmaking. Oculus Rift, an absolutely amazing, outstanding device. Got a lot of those that people can play around with.
Oh, that's cool.
Very, very cool.
And there's some New Zealand game developers there as well.
Yeah, exactly. So we've got Telecom Homegrown, which is basically Telecom is working with the New Zealand Gamers Development Association, and they've created this environment where the game developers get to come in and show off their wares. We've got 20 of them coming in, and they'll do it in 10 stands. So basically, they get half a day each, which is great for them and great for us to have them on board. And its ability for New Zealand to really showcase some of these amazing talents. And then Grounding Gear Game would be one of the ones that lead the pack on that, I would argue.
And this is going to be an interactive with the audience as well. It's not just going to be a stand up and say, hey, here's something wonderful we've done.
They've actually got stands. So you can go up. They've got screens with laptops. They'll be able to show you the games that they've got. Some of them are very indie, and it will be almost like that indie game movie kind of thing where you'll see some stuff that's absolutely crazy. I'm not entirely 100% sure made it in, but we've got, I think it's a wheelchair simulator, where there's like a game, like an actual game, a guy who's said was actually created a game for that, which was amazing, with some Oculus Rift games from Kiwi developers. And yes, the Telecom have been great. They've come on board and really kind of fronting that homegrown stuff. And on the other side, we've got LG who have been great and fronting the speaker side. So, you know, we've got these great partners in as well who've really helped build that kind of the content that we've asked for. I mean, we really wanted it to be content heavy as much as we could in this kind of show. Kim.com on stage battling it out against 100 people on the Sunday. Modern Warfare will be absolutely hilarious to watch on all accounts. Absolutely.
Yeah, oh, it sounds like a really really fun weekend.
Mm, absolutely. And I mean, for us, we've tried to not price it out of the market as well. So, you know, adults are $19 and a student's $14 for a day. And, you know, going and being one of the first in New Zealand to play on Xbox One and PlayStation 4 and listen to speakers and participate in free workshops and play Oculus Rift and see everything else, you know, we've got a video console museum, which is, you know, great for us, obviously being in a position where we probably have a nostalgic relationship to gaming, which the young kids might not have yet, and they'll appreciate when they get to that stage. But I can't wait to see the Odyssey consoles and the Sega Master Systems and all of this kind of stuff that these guys are bringing in as well. So that's going to be fun.
Sega Master System, that's not old school. It goes back further than that. But no, that sounds good. So Vector Arena, yep. Now, tickets, do you buy them online?
Yeah, I would suggest buy them online. They're still available online. Definitely buy them online. You don't have to have your paper ticket on the door either. It works fine showing the mobile barcode, or the email that you get with the barcode is fine. If you're not wanting to miss out on any of the speakers and you wanted to make sure that you get in the door, we know that walk-ups tend to be the thing that people do on expos, because it's on the weekend. They go, what am I going to do? Oh, I'm going to go to the Digital Nations Expo. Great in theory. In practice, I think you'll want to be through those doors as soon as you can and getting your handles on a controller.
Good. All right. Well, we'll be looking forward to having a look over it this weekend. Now, a bunch of gadgets that have sort of passed through our way recently. And what shall we have a look at first? Now, we've got a new Ultrabook here from Asus. Now, Alistair, you were having a look at this one earlier. This just got announced earlier on in the month at IFA in Berlin. It's not going to be available, I think, probably commercially for maybe sort of December timeframe. What's your take on it first up? I mean, this is a pretty high-end Ultrabook, isn't it?
It is. This is the new UX 301 is the one that we have, which is the lower spec of the two new ones. It's the successor to the UX 31 that I nearly bought last time I bought a laptop, but that one didn't do touch, and Windows 8 being new, I wanted touch. The new one does do touch. This has got a full HD screen and a 13-inch form factor. Peter's casually holding it in two fingers at the moment because it is that Ultrabook size. One of the funny things is that the top cover of it, the outside of the lid, is actually Gorilla Glass rather than the spun aluminium or spun whatever it was that was the ZenBook trademark. But it looks to be a very nice device. It's 8 gigs of RAM, a Core i7 CPU in it. The higher end one has a really high def, one of those multiplied pixel displays. It's something like 5 megapixels worth of screen display, and has a discrete graphics card in it as well, and that looks to be a very interesting device, although I imagine you'll spend a little bit of money getting that in your hands.
Yeah, well, both of these are pretty the new ZenBook is a pretty high end device, so yeah, they're talking it being available, you know, this one's the full HD display, but also in what they call WQHD, which is 2560 pixels by 1440 pixels. And we are starting to see a number of devices come through with these types of resolutions, and even higher, up to 3200, I think, with the new Samsung one coming through. So pretty impressive hardware. And because it's using the fourth gen core processor as well, pretty power efficient and a reasonably sort of slim and light machine, you know, SSD storage and so on. one of the first of the new Windows, I guess, devices to come through with the AC wireless or the gigabit wireless. So we're now starting to see, and I think we'll see that with a lot of the other Ultrabooks, will come through with that much improved Wi-Fi performance, which becomes essential once you start wanting to not plug in an Ethernet cable. Yeah. Although, still bear in mind that when we say gigabit wireless, it's actually nowhere near that. Usually in practice, those are the sort of the theoretical numbers, right?
When was the last time you had any speed on any device that actually lived up to what it said on the box?
Yeah, very
it's
true.
Like it's like a Big Mac, isn't it? You look at it, it looks absolutely beautiful until you get handed it. I mean, this is a beautiful device, though. It looks absolutely stunning.
And I think it's good to see a vendor like Asus, which a few years ago was pretty famous for their netbooks, and they were pretty cheap and nasty sort of looking pieces of hardware. It just looked like really cheap plastic and so on. And now we are seeing really nice premium gear, and that never used to be a hallmark of PC or Windows hardware. It was always, just an exclusive domain of Apple to have this premium gear. I think the price on this is going to be fairly premium when we see it launched in New Zealand. We don't have anything, confirmed yet. It is certainly at that higher end. But, very, very, very nice looking piece of hardware, that's for sure.
It's interesting as well, actually, on that note, the fact that they've added audio by Bang Olufsen in it as well, which is clearly, again, just that wanting to be associated with a premium brand, that to me is just another indication, like you said, that they're wanting to be that sexy kind of device. Mm. I mean, I don't Gorilla Glass on the outside.
That's a straight style thing. I believe HP have been doing a bit of that themselves as well. So, it may be the fashionable thing to do is to put glass over metal.
It's certainly unnecessary, though, isn't it?
And replaceable, or how are we...
What do you do when you break it?
Because, Gorilla Glass to me has become almost like... for some reason, I have this feeling. I've had devices for years and years and years, and I never had any problems with them breaking. And then since they started putting, and I'm not saying that it's because of the Gorilla Glass at all, because it's good, but it is interesting to see within the last few years, the amount of devices with broken screens, it just seems to be exploding quite literally. So do you put it on an entire laptop on the front, and how do you replace this if it breaks?
And also, because it's an Ultrabook and it's so slim, there is so little actual solid meat to the lid that it actually does concern me.
I would be worried about it.
Whereas the outgoing model with a more steel or more metal in that lid, I think felt a little more solid, although not a huge amount more solid.
Yeah. It certainly looks nice. And
it does, absolutely.
I think we'll find out over time how tough they are. But one looks like it's been bounced around all over the place over.
It is the engineering pre-production sample model, so it's been through a lot of reviewers.
Exactly. So, it's had a few hands on it between Australia and having just arrived in New Zealand. So, looks good, and it's certainly still in one piece, so a good sign. Now, a few other bits from Asus. They've got, we haven't got it here, but we were just having a look earlier on at a new gaming laptop they've also got coming through, which looks very much in the vein of the what's Dell's gaming
Alienware.
Brand? Alienware.
That's exactly my thought on the styling on those.
Very sort of Alienware type styling on their new gaming laptop. So if you're interested in that sort of really high spec gaming laptop, then worth having a look at what they've got coming into the market as well. But a couple of other tablets here. We've got their Memo Pad HD 7, which is a sort of a lower end 7-inch tablet there with typical sort of specs, front and rear camera look quite reasonable. 1.2 megapixel front facing camera, 5 megapixel sort of rear facing, 1080p video. The HD7 is coming in at $279, so a mid sort of price point, shall we say, in terms of
nice pink one you got.
In terms of pricing, all sorts of colours. So we've got pink, and there's a sort of a fluoro green one here, but also available in more conservative colours.
And it seems to be a nice, solid, chunky 7-inch laptop. It's not a tiny, thin device. I wouldn't be so concerned about letting my kids use it. My kids are a little older. They take care of gear now. But when they're a little younger, you'd be concerned about giving them an 8mm thick laptop tablet and be worried that it'd get damaged. These are coming at a price point where you wouldn't be so concerned, and they feel solid enough that they might even bounce occasionally when dropped by a child.
Yeah, and I mean the accessory sort of covers and things, one of them which acts as a stand, look quite good, and I think will be pretty reasonably priced here, sort of $30-$40 type range. So that's the HD7, and then they've got the Mimo Pad FHD10, which is a full HD screen and a Atom processor in it. 1.6 gigahertz. Looks quite nice. Similar sort of camera and so on. And I think that one's going to be the model they're launching in New Zealand. 32 gigs worth of storage, $499 for sort of 10 inch. So reasonably sort of typical pricing there. Not aiming right at the top end of the market. Aiming, I guess, at a pretty accessible price point. So, yeah.
Yeah, and I've been using the device right through the show read all of the news on it. I hadn't realised that it was an Atom-based tablet. This is the first time I've had an Android device with a non-ARM CPU in it, and runs beautifully. The high-def display is nice. I mean, the resolution is more than full HD. It's according to the specs here, 1920x1200, which is a pretty high-res screen for this size of device.
And I think, from what we're hearing, we're going to see, many more of these devices come through that have got an Intel, processor inside them rather than the ARM chips that we've seen in the past. And, that's where, Intel just seem to be putting a huge amount of effort into making sure that they're able to compete strongly, really, in every area that they play in.
It's a really nice device.
It is. And another perspective on it is that because it's the same CPU that you could run Windows on, it should lower the engineering cost to develop new tablets, because you just develop one common platform and push onto it the operating system of choice at the ship time, or potentially even give customers the choice of operating system when they buy the device.
Yeah, I think there are probably a couple of sort of small technical challenges in terms of the differences, but I'm pretty sure one of the devices that I looked at CES, there was basically two identical products, one which had Android, one that had Windows. Certainly some of the engineering demonstration products and so on from Intel were identical between whichever operating system. So I think that's probably a good point there, Alistair, and will undoubtedly make it easier for manufacturers to put Windows on these tablets, and particularly the smaller form factor ones,
and eventually lead to us having cheaper devices to buy, because there's less engineering effort.
That's what we're hoping for.
Yeah.
We're always looking for cheaper devices.
Or more margin.
Now Samsung continuing to bring a lot of new products to market. Now, we've been playing around with the new version of the Galaxy Note, the Galaxy Note 3, and I've been on that for a little while, and pretty impressed with it, actually. It certainly is really, really snappy, enjoying the move to a full HD screen, which the previous Note didn't have. You've got the screens bumped up a little bit from that original 5.5-inch processor to 5.7-inch, and the device itself doesn't seem to be really noticeably much different in terms of size. I don't think it's really grown. You know,
it's marginally larger, but it's in terms of profile, but thinner. And Note 2 has been my daily drive for the last nearly a year, and the Note 3 feels significantly smaller in my hand.
Yeah, and what do you think about the back? The plastic back that actually looks like it's stitched leather.
It reminds me of the original Nexus 7's back that was Steve McQueen's driving glove feel. I think that same sort of meme is going on in here of looking quite sophisticated. It works fairly well for me. I like the look of the style.
I actually prefer it to even, looking at my Samsung Galaxy 4 and I'm comparing it, I actually probably would rather have it, actually.
Yeah, it's really nice. I was actually surprised when I heard about it. I thought, oh, that's disgusting. That is really going to... It's just going to look silly. But it actually looks fine.
Yeah,
I was surprised. So
It's a bit retro style that I think I've seen a couple of other things that have the chrome and leather feel.
You're right. It does feel a bit like early 1960s. PDAs.
Yeah.
Like, it feels like, when it was the executive guy who had the fake mahogany paneling in his car. I was sitting there chain smoking. Somehow it brings back a little bit of that feeling.
And but they get away with it. The early Filofax as well, with the leather cover.
Exactly, the leather file. But they get away with it. I think it really works.
Yeah.
And it's got to be better than Gorilla Glass on both sides of a phone, right? So
has to be.
Yep.
So next up is the Galaxy Tab 3. Now, we've got here the 8-inch model. There's a 7-inch, 8-inch, and 10-inch. Now, the 7-inch, I believe, comes in at a reasonably sharp price of, what's that landing at, $299. So not a whole lot more than the Asus. The 8-inch comes in at $479. And the 10.1-inch at $549, so quite a variance there in pricing. But I think the difference is in the 8-inch and the 10-inch from the details we've been given is both of those have LTE, 3G and LTE capability on board. So that's that's sort of the big benefit that you can use them on the go. What are your impressions of this?
I love it. I love it. I mean, it's
a good form factor.
It's
isn't
a
it?
Great form factor. I mean, the thing is with these devices, the reason why I never bought the first iPad is I still see the function of it being an e-reader as being something I really like to be able to do with it. And this here, from a weight perspective, and actually just from the format itself, fills that promise of actually being able to do that while using it for other things as well. You know, I actually do believe that's. It's a great little device.
Yeah, I think this 7-8-inch space is the really good consumption device where you can watch a video on it, you can read a document. It doesn't have to be an EPUB document. It can be a proper PDF document. It's one of the reasons I've now got my Mac Mini, my iPad Mini, is so that I can read PDF documents. I also have a Kindle. I use that for reading fiction. Mm. But I can't watch a movie on it. I can't read the newspaper on it so easily. Whereas the 7-inch tablet seems to be a great form for it.
Yeah,
and the 8-inch really is a good size too, isn't it? Because this one's the 8-inch.
Oh, is this the 8-inch?
And, so that's got the SIM card slot on the side, which I believe the 7 doesn't have that, so that's the sort of probably the key difference in terms of there being a big price difference between those models. But
and it's got a clear and really bright display, a very vibrant display, which I think is extremely important. And as you said as well, for that kind of video playing when you're traveling or whatever you might be doing, I mean, this is perfect.
Yeah, I think good, pretty good products. We're talking 16 gigs of RAM across, or 16 gigs of storage in both of these models. Not massive, but they're extendable and micro SD, and that seems to sort of be becoming the norm in the tablets anyway. you know, more often than not, they've got this type of storage, certainly as a starting point. And I think in other markets, you'll see, you know, a bit more variety, but New Zealand being a smaller market, we don't necessarily see all the different sizes launched here locally.
Although Samsung do tend to bring most of their devices here. We see a huge number. You see the stands and the big box retailers with, you know, 8 different Samsung devices, different forms. They have the Notes, the Tabs, the
devices. I like it.
All right, well, we've run a little bit longer than we probably planned to, but that's us for this episode. So thanks, everyone, for listening in. Now, guys, where do we find you online, Alistair?
My online brand is all Demitas, which is my company name. So my Twitter handle is at DemitasNZ, and you can find me blogging at demitas.co.nz, amongst a number of other places.
Oh, very good.
Well, I must say, I've started this whole Twitter thing. I tweet at things, and people tweet at me. So DNZ Pete is where you can find me, and I will tweet at you, hopefully, if you tweet at me. And I also, obviously, Digital Nations with a Z at the end, .com, or digitalnations.co.nz. That's where we hang out. That's for the show coming up this weekend. But, find me in the Twitter sphere.
Oh, that's great. Well, thanks, guys, for joining us. You can also track me down at Paul Spain on Twitter, and I'm across Google Plus and so on, Facebook as well. And you can find the NZ Tech Podcast online at nztechpodcast.com. We're at NZ Tech Podcast on Twitter and facebook.com/nztechpodcast. So look forward to hearing from you in any of those places, or just drop us an email, feedback at nztechpodcast.com. All right, see ya.